Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for April 28th, 2022, and a lot of topics to cover tonight in the ongoing series, my year-long venture into discussing my history, the history of my discoveries, with a lot of anecdotes and a lot of information, a lot of particular things that I had vision of that I was able to see because of my unique position in the science world and in the political world, the politics of science. And this week, as I mentioned at the end of last week's show, I'm going to take off a little bit now that I have discovered who Velikovsky is. I'm going to talk about the papers, etc., that I wrote. And this occurred after I left Cornell. In fact, I was discussing this with a friend of mine on the phone. It was right after the Cornell, after I was politely requested to leave for the second time. And so I was talking to a friend of mine on the phone who was an author and a scholar, and I was talking about my work of comets becoming planets and things like this. And he goes, it sounds like this Velikovsky guy. And I, well, who's this Velikovsky guy? So he, you know, I took a look, and he didn't know much about Velikovsky, but other than, you know, what the normal public would know. So I took a look into this, and then I, of course, this opened up the doors. It might be more like opening up the Pandora's box of the Velikovsky world. That's where I learned about Carl Sagan and the 1974 AAAS, the American Association of the Advancement of Science, trial that Velikovsky was put under. And at this point, I realized, oh my goodness, this is what all of the hubbub was about when I was at Cornell. When I was at Cornell, I had no clue the beehive that I was sitting in. And here I am writing a one-page document accusing NASA scientists of hiding data that comets can become planets in the middle of Cornell University, which is the peak, the pinnacle of the entire astronomical world, literally, and with this dogma that is firmly based on proving Velikovsky wrong. And here I am with access to NASA data and publishing and basically laying out an entire theoretical work, not just about comets, but about the entire range of the solar system, the Voyager, the Pioneer space probe data, the Venus space probe data that showed the high temperature of Venus and that Venus was a young planet, and my archaeological work that goes back to my days in Mexico 10 years earlier. And Quetzalcoatl and the plumed serpent god of the night sky and all of this. And of course, like I said, when I was at Cornell, I had no idea. So just as I'm out of there and leaving, I find out about Velikovsky. So what I want to do, because this issue of Velikovsky is so distorted, and now after decades of experience, one thing, I'll just kind of summarize this by saying there were some very well-intentioned people, some very honest people, and there were some very shady characters that surrounded Velikovsky. And some of them are still out there pounding the pavement today using Velikovsky's name to promote themselves, stealing information from other people, pretending that they're people who they aren't, pretending they're physicists, pretending they're, it's a charlatans would be the best term you could use. That would be kind. And then I met people on the editorial staff of Kronos, and it turns out that this gave me a venue, a platform for publishing what I could not publish in the astrophysics journals. And so Kronos is a journal. It's no longer in existence. Spelt with a K, Kronos, and talked to them about my work, and so anyway, we had an agreement that I would publish a three-part paper, and that you will see the final product in the appendix of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book. And it's I've gone back through this recently just to kind of prep myself for this show. And that paper is so dense. Any given sentence in there could be expanded into an entire graduate level course. But that paper is the results. That's the summary of the 300-page book that I had when I was at Cornell, that I brought in basically on the celestial mechanics, all of the other issues there. And like I say, this is not, if you cannot listen to this show and understand my science. What I'm talking about now are of the history, the timing of all of these events. And so I started writing the papers for the three-part comet paper, and they were going out one at a time. They appeared, I believe, in successive issues of Kronos. And this is back in the old days where it would be a typed paper and then submitted and mailed in and then edited back and forth. And certainly before the day of electronic communication by email, etc. But had a guy there. His name was Leroy Ellenberger. I'm not sure if Leroy is still around with us today. The editor-in-chief was Louis Greenberg, a very astute scholar, very dedicated to the proposition of getting true information out there. But Ellenberger was like a pit bull. Let me just say that. He was like, and he was constantly writing to people like Sagan and other scientists in engaging them in these controversial topics. And it did nothing for Velikovsky, let me just put it this way, because these people really didn't know what the true issues were. And of course, all it did was offend the scientists that were standard scientists and just make it more apparent that this affected Velikovsky's own image, that he was just surrounded by these nutcases. And whether they were well-intentioned or they had anything real to say or not, the end result was that they came off as being like lunatic fringe is what they were called, like pseudoscience, lunatic fringe, all of these other things. And so here I am with a platform to publish, but not a good one. It is not a good platform because of the reputation it had. And there were people like Juergens, who was an electrical engineer, from what I understand. And he had dabbled in kind of the thoughts about what electrical conditions would be like in outer space, etc. And Milton, Earl Milton, and other people. But they really didn't have a handle on this. And that's because, really, there was no information available. There were no space probes. There were no... they didn't have the access to the things that I did when I was at Cornell, but they had been at this back since in the 70s, in accompanying Velikovsky. But there is a person who I will say is fundamental in understanding Velikovsky, and that is a guy who I consider a very good friend. I got to know him back in the day, and his name is Warner Sizemore. Now, I have some interviews with Warner, and Warner passed away here a couple years ago. I got a letter from his son, an email stating that Warner had passed away. And I knew he was getting older, and, people don't live forever. So anyway, I made a point. This was back when I was doing my paid cast, so this is back around 2015, 2016. It was before I did my paid cast. This is back, it might be as many as 10 years ago. I recorded a couple sessions with Warner, and we set it up. We recorded the phone calls, and you can see those interviews. These are classic interviews, which are very important. Warner Sizemore was the personal secretary of Velikovsky. He lived right next door to Velikovsky in Princeton, and he was in Velikovsky's house a lot. So when Albert Einstein came over, Warner was there. When they had supper, Warner was there. If Warner was very familiar with the friendship between Velikovsky and Einstein. Einstein would come over to Velikovsky's house and play the violin before supper. These were, and of course, the history of Velikovsky and Einstein goes back to before they arrived in the U.S. Velikovsky was born in Russia. He was a scholar. He eventually curated a museum in Israel of history. And Velikovsky was an expert, one of the few worldwide experts on the reading and translation of cuneiform and ancient texts. And so at any rate, Velikovsky was an esoteric guy. He was a psychologist. He was a PhD in psychologist. He was a professional psychologist. And that's where he came up with some of his terms like collective amnesia, of the collective amnesia of society, of these tremendously violent events in human history that destroyed the entire planet and civilization and the result. And so anyway, let me just say this also, just terminating the conversation about Warner here, is Warner recorded all of Velikovsky's talks. He went with him. He traveled with him. And so Warner had this treasure trove of information about Velikovsky. And so when I interviewed Warner, it was very specific. We wanted to get to the heart of the issue here, and also some of the charlatans that were surrounding Velikovsky, which I say are some of them still out there today, pounding the pavement, trying to make a buck, and some of them being supported by the CIA under the table as disinformation sources. Although, of course, when the CIA does that, they don't let the people know that that's where the money is coming from, but they have handlers. And it turns out that Tom Van Flandern was one of this group's handlers, etc. But Warner Sizemore, I asked him about this group, and he said they were con men. They were always trying to con Velikovsky. And anyway, I could go into a lot of these details. But all I'm saying is today there are still a group of con men out there trying to use Velikovsky's name to promote themselves, to ride the wave, so to speak, and make money, and then copy other people's work, etc., like my own. But I encourage you to get the 2-DVD set. It's 18 hours MP3 lectures. It's mainly my lectures on Planet X and ancient celestial disasters. It's available on my webpage and available in the book sets. I don't sell these individually anymore. Nobody comes in and buys one thing. You have to buy the entire set of books really to understand what I've presented to the public. And that's about 10% of what my total volume of work is. That's what I've chosen to release to the public. But Warner's interviews are on that 2-CD set. It's 2 CDs. It's called Planet X and Ancient, The Physics of Planet X and Ancient Celestial Disasters. And two of those recordings are of Warner. Very important. So anyway, like I say, Louis Greenberg, a very honest, very strict, very good scholar, was the editor-in-chief of Kronos. And then Leroy Ellenberger was my personal contact, and he was very good at, I would write something and he'd say, well, I don't like the way this is presented or something like that. He said, you know, and so he was really good at molding the message. You know, he was a good editor, and that's what a good editor does. They give a fresh eye, so to speak, because I had my way of writing, etc. But the end result was the three-part comment paper, which is appendix number 2 in the back of my book, Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, a very dense paper. And I read from that last week when I was talking about where the term electric universe came from and who popularized it. It was from my work. It was from the conclusion of part 3 of that three-part comment paper. Okay, so at any rate, let's take a look a little bit more about Velikovsky and the whole Velikovsky issue. And you could summarize it like this. Carl Sagan took the torch, the banner, the Joan of Arc of astronomy, leading the banner, leading the parade, the charge, because Velikovsky, now understand, this is 1974 when the AAAS meeting was held Sagan inviting Velikovsky, and an intention was to bring all of this manpower out of academia to attack Velikovsky and basically do him in. But this had been going on before, because Velikovsky's books had been selling since the 1950s. Worlds in Collision was published in 1950, so this is 24 years that Velikovsky has been selling his books, World in Collision, Ages in Chaos, and Earth in Upheaval, and then Velikovsky had other books. There were a number of other books that Velikovsky had after that. And these were selling, translated into 14 languages. Everybody was believing this. Venus was a comet that became the planet Venus, and the mastodons. He had pointed out that the mastodons in Siberia were flash frozen with the fresh semi-tropical plants in their throats, that they didn't belong in Siberia, and all of these other issues. So the three books were Worlds in Collisions, where he talked about the historical data and the fact that Velikovsky was, as I say, a scholar. He was reading ancient texts, and his goal was a very esoteric goal. It had nothing to do with comets or Venus or other topics. He was looking for a timeline in ancient history, because if you went back and he was reading texts from all of these different countries, from the East, from the Mideast, from the, all of these different texts that he had availability of, and he wanted a timeline. He said all these countries were separated, and so he said, if I could find some major worldwide event, an event that everybody talked about somewhere in their history, we could line up the zero line of all of these various civilizations along this event that happened, and we would have be able to chronicleize history and put them into perspective at the same point in history. And what he came up with, what the thing that he repeatedly saw, was the Venus event. And there were various names for it, the Maya, the Mideastern records, etc. All of them pointed towards this major event, the Israelites coming out of Egypt. And by the way, this is very interesting, very interesting. If you look at Velikovsky's work, he's Jewish. He was from Russia, he lived in Israel. And, of course, came to the United States around the same time as Einstein and all of these other German. I talked about Hans Bethe, who I'd met at Cornell. And they all ended up in the United States. But Velikovsky was at Princeton, and Einstein was at Princeton. And, of course, Einstein was Jewish also. But the thing that you will see, that if you look at Velikovsky's work closely, he's very specific that it was the group of Israelites who followed Moses out of Egypt. And of course, this has been distorted in history, and there have been a group of people who made claim even to be Jews, who were not Jews, who made the claim of being with Moses coming out of Egypt when they were Israelites. The Israelites, and I have talked about this before on my other radio shows, the Israelites were fair-skinned, blue-eyed, blonde-haired people who were subjected into slavery because of the economics. It was like one of the captivities, the great captivities. But at any rate, they were enslaved. And there's a lot of question also to the level of slavery. What they're realizing now is that these were very industrious people, and they were craftsmen also who lived in Egypt. But be that as it may, it was like a country, kind of like some countries today, I won't mention names, in which the leader thinks that the people belong to them as subjects, as property. And that was the case in Egypt. So anyway, there was the conflict between Moses and the Pharaoh to take the Israelites out of Egypt. But my point is that it's very clear, and Velikovsky is very clear, that they were Israelites, and so that followed Moses. And of course, the Moses event was instrumental. It was fundamental to the entire story of Venus coming through the solar system, because that's when it happened. And so they talk about the rain of fire and brimstone, the seven plagues that associated prior to the comet arriving, and then the night when everything just went black. And all, well, it's too complicated to even cover here, so I'm just throwing out a few bones basically here to give you a flavor of the day. But Velikovsky's books were amazing and very on target. But what Velikovsky was looking for was information on calendars. He was not searching to find a problem with astronomy or anything like that, or trying to project theoretical work. And it turns out that Albert Einstein was very interested in Velikovsky's work. And like I say, they were good friends. Velikovsky's book, Worlds in Collision, was open up with all of the rest of the materials pushed aside from Albert Einstein's desk. When Albert Einstein died, his secretary went into his office. Everything was pushed aside and was opened up, Worlds in Collision, in the center of his desk. And why was Velikovsky's work so much of interest to Albert Einstein? That's because Einstein was looking for an electromagnetic connection to use in place of gravity in general relativity. In other words, he was looking for the total field, as Einstein called it. So anyway, this is a very entangled story. And let me just, before I forget it, I'll mention a book that was very well written, probably one of the best histories of the Velikovsky affair, if you want to call it that, is by Charles Ginnenthal. And it is called, I forget the title, but anyway, just look up Charles Ginnenthal, Velikovsky, and you'll find the book. Very well researched, very well credited. You'll find my name in there. Anyway, let me try and summarize this whole Velikovsky issue. And by the way, I was in a debate on Coast to Coast AM. I was invited by George Norrie. He set it up. And, of course, I had been on Coast to Coast a lot talking about my world of comets, etc. And that went back to the Art Bell days. I was on Art Bell's show. I was a friend with Art Bell. And back in the old Hale Bopp days, which was just insanity, I'll be talking about that in future lectures. But George Norrie invited me, he called me up, and he says, hey, we want to set up this debate with you and a top NASA scientist, and it turned out to be Dr. David Morrison. And so we went on this debate, and before the debate, Dr. Morrison wanted to talk to me personally before the debate to set up the ground rules to make sure I was not some raving nutcase. And so we talked, and we actually had a couple conversations, and we set up the ground rules, and we said no personal attacks, no ranting and raving about, that it was strictly science-based, and that we would go toe-to-toe on the radio, on basically international radio, dealing with the scientific issues regarding Velikovsky, regarding my work with the electrical nature of the universe, etc. And then I didn't realize it, but they had a call-in vote going on when this debate was going on. So it was a landmark event. Dr. David Morrison was Carl Sagan's student. So this was the closest thing you could get to Carl Sagan, because Carl had already passed away. And so, Dr. David Morrison was the head of the Near Earth Asteroid Program at NASA, studying objects that would come near Earth and cause damage. So he was the perfect person for this. And I won the debate with a call-in vote. A substantial amount, but I think it was something like the low 50s% for my side of the argument and in the high 40s for Dr. David Morrison, something that was about the result. In a presidential election, it would have been a landslide. But given the huge amount of publicity against Velikovsky, the huge amount of effort that NASA had with the outreach agents out there, just squelching any opposition at all. I was amazed. I thought I would just lose, 100-0. There'd be no way I could possibly win on the radio, etc. And I won the debate. And very clearly, I think scientific point for scientific point, I won the debate. In fact, David Morrison actually broke down at the end and started with a little bit of personal attacks, etc., because I think he realized that I had him. I had him on the mat, so to speak. But and on scientific issues, not because of rabble-rousing or name-calling or tradition or we all believe this or whatever. But at any rate, the point is that the public simply believes Velikovsky and Velikovsky's story. It's a very believable story. And there's something kind of like deer in the headlights or a deer in the woods. When he smells that scent of man coming along, he knows to be afraid of it. It's instinctive. And when man looks up and sees comets up in the sky, they instinctively think of danger. And NASA has done everything in its power to squelch that belief. But anyway, okay, so with this in mind, what I want to do is kind of summarize the whole Velikovsky affair. Velikovsky was a man way ahead of his time, involved in very esoteric research, dealing with calendars that zero point in time, reading ancient texts, etc. And he discovered the Venus event. He published his books, and then he did geological research on the mastodons and pole shift related information. And prior to him, there was Hapgood, etc., dealing with the other types of geological data that indicated there was a pole shift. And so, at any rate, Velikovsky starts promoting and doing tours and talking tours, etc. Warner Sizemore is recording all of this, going along with it. Velikovsky and Einstein are good friends. Einstein is very interested because he wants to see what is this electrical component to the to outer space, to the celestial sphere. And he's desperately looking for that because he thinks that there's something there, a nugget, and he's right. But there was no spacecraft data there for Einstein to harvest. If he would have lived longer, he would have probably discovered what I discovered, which was the induced electric dipole redshift, which is the cause of bending of light, not gravity, and the redshift, which was the basis of the redshift we see when we look out at everything in the universe. All the light coming to us from foreign galaxies, etc., is redshifted, and from quasars. But it's due to the induced electric dipole redshift, which is a result of the non-uniform electric field around these fusion-based objects. And, of course, that's part of my work that I discovered, when I was at Cornell and, verified in the laboratory. But back to the Velikovsky situation. So Velikovsky is a guy who was right on, but he made a mistake. Being an honest guy, he went out and he tried to take astronomical theories of the day and mold them to what he had done. And one of his biggest mistakes was that he said that Venus, this giant comet, popped out of Jupiter, was somehow expelled out of the atmosphere of Jupiter. And what really happened in reality, which I discovered, was that it was captured by Jupiter. And nobody saw this incoming nucleus that was the nucleus of the comet Venus as it came in by Jupiter. And when it hit Jupiter, at Jupiter's local discharge, etc., this nucleus explodes into this giant comet, comes out of Jupiter. In the ancient story is that Venus was born of Jupiter. And this is the whole mythology that the Greeks had, which was later passed down and changed a bit by the Romans. And that's what is passed down to us, this whole mythological entourage of deities related to the planets, etc. Okay, so Velikovsky made some mistakes. One was that Venus popped out of Jupiter, which is not the case. It was captured very close, but there again, he was trying to have scientific results, which were, he just didn't have the right information at the time. And then he tried to talk about astronomy and Snowball Comet model, which was then prominent in the astronomical community, the Whipple's Iceball Comet model, which later became the Snowball Comet model. So Velikovsky made a tactical error. What he should have come back to Sagan and said, well, I'm not an astronomer. You guys figure it out. You're the ones that are, you know, the extra special experts in astronomy. I'm just presenting this calendar data, and this is what the calendar data says. You can ignore it if you want, etc. But but Velikovsky stepped across that line where he was not an expert, and that's where they nailed him. That's where they nailed Velikovsky, because he was making these geological claims, etc., which were valid. But given the geological theories of the day, the astronomical theories of the day, it did not make sense. So all Sagan had to do was put all of this astronomical theory in a box, geological, you know, all of these other, you know, physical theories in a box, and say, Velikovsky doesn't fit in our box, therefore Velikovsky is proven unequivocally wrong. And that's the big mistake of Sagan. Because Sagan did this in 1974 before any satellites had gone out to the planets. As soon as the satellites started hitting the planets, and that's when I ended up at Cornell and seeing the data, that's when the reality started to set in. And hey, there were magnetic fields, something Velikovsky predicted. There were electrical activity, things going on out there. But Sagan and the boys at NASA never, ever contemplated the reality that everything they were doing was wrong. And when I came along, I had just free rein. I had my theoretical work in place. And I was able to put this entire scope of theoretical work from the beginning of galaxies, the structure in galactic arms, the moons at Saturn, the way comets work, how the solar wind works, how it creates this nebular ion cloud, which was being mistaken for the remnant of the Big Bang, the radiation off of this nebular ion cloud, and on and on and on. So what I did was not just a comet theory or something, this one specific thing. I did the entire spectrum on planetary formation, capture, how comets work, how little comets work. And before anybody had ever been to a comet, the first cometary visit was done in about 1986 with Giacobini-Zinner. The ISEE-3 satellite, which was renamed IC-3, was the first planetary or the first cometary visitor from Earth, a satellite type of visitor. And it took in a lot of data. And they made some mistakes there also, but it was very clear at that point that comets were not ice balls nor dirty snowballs. And I talked about the story where I was at the American Geophysical Union meeting in around 1986 and had supper with Jonathan Eberhardt, who is one of the editor journalists from Science News, Tycho von Rosenvinge, who was a top NASA scientist, physicist on the ISEE-3 satellite, and I'm having supper with them and at a sushi bar out in San Francisco. And Jonathan then goes back and writes this article about and mentions me and kind of slams the dirty snowball comet model, saying that it's a bit dirtier than expected, etc. And so at any rate, this is when they called up Jonathan and said, don't ever talk to McCanny again. And so, you know, you could see this tracing all the way up. And I've told the story about Dan Golden back in the early 2000s, where he was the keynote speaker at the IEEE Engineer of the Year Award for Tony Scarpelli. And Tony mentions my name because Tony had been the producer on my show that was done for cable TV, and Dan Golden shriveled up like a prune and would not respond, and the only thing he could say is no comment when Tony Scarpelli asked about James McCanny. So anyway, this carried on through NASA all the way through the 90s, through the 2000s, and of course up to today. But getting back to Velikovsky and the whole Velikovsky affair. So Velikovsky collected this entourage of what you might call eccentrics, well-intentioned people, genuine nutcases, con men, and they were very vocal. They were very vocal, and that's what Velikovsky was just. And by the way, that's not the only reason I work alone. I've always worked alone in my career, but I've seen people come and go. I've seen people come and then change. And then they want to be associated with you and work with you. And then all of a sudden they're somebody else or they're plants from the CIA or something else. I have always worked alone. And guess what? I'm still ticking. And a lot of these other people are nowhere to be found, etc. So anyway, that's kind of it in a nutshell. That Velikovsky was a guy way ahead of his time. He was right on a lot of topics. His main core presentation was right on target. The whole issue with Venus being a comet, becoming a planet, the standard astronomy, astrophysics, space science world had no clue that what they were doing was completely wrong, that they were marching down the wrong road, that they had no idea what they were doing. And I found that out when I was at Cornell. I would sit in these meetings and I'd watch this data come in, realizing, first of all, that the spacecraft were incorrectly designed, and then realizing that these scientists had no idea what they were doing and coming up with these totally bogus concepts to explain things, or simply sweeping the data under the rug, which was in many of the cases, that's what happened. And so at any rate, that's the standard science side of it. And then Velikovsky, surrounded by this entourage that I just described, and then to understand that there was a difference between Tier 1 science and Tier 2 science. So Carl Sagan was the epitome of Tier 2 science. The public, what you see, he got the Cosmos show, a scripted Hollywood production, laying out all the standard theories of the day that would be carried off far into the future, including up to today, and then certainly going beyond, because nobody can talk about anything different than these icy little wanderers, etc., and comets, and, you know, ice ball comets and dirty snowball comets, etc. And so add that layer to this whole thing where the Tier 1 scientists are communicating with me, understanding that I'm totally correct about what I'm doing, and then everybody at that layer understanding that Tier 2 science is the bogus science that they spend a lot of time and a lot of money that's visible in these universities. Look at Cornell, top university, but populated, physically visible with Tier 2 scientists. This is the level, but also in the background, Tier 1 scientists working hidden in a sense, but controlling the narrative of the Tier 2 people. And nothing could be more telling than, I tell this story because it's very telling. I was at American Geophysical Union meeting one time, and I was in a session dealing with solar physics. And there were, you know, these sessions, there might be 20 people. There's 20,000 scientists at one of these American Geophysical Union meetings talking about every topic scientific under the sun. But this one maybe have had 20 people, and these are rather very specialized groups. So we're talking about magnetic conditions relative to the sun and solar conditions. And so the presenter is talking about, and he's constantly referring to sending his data up to this military group that oversees, that they don't really know who it is. They send this data there. And at the end of the talk, somebody raises their hand and he says, well, what did they tell you back? This, you're sending your data up to this group that may use it. They are analyzing it, et cetera. He said, what did they say back to you? And this guy goes, oh, they never respond to us. We don't even know who they are. They may use it. They may not. We don't know if it's good or bad or indifferent or if they use it or not use it. They don't even communicate. They never communicate back with us. He had to send all his findings up to this other layer that he had no visibility of. That's the Tier 1 layer of science. And I know because these people have come out and talked to me. And they're just normal people. They're just very regular people, but very good scientists who've been plucked up into Tier 1 science. I call it military science because it very much is controlled in a military fashion, and it's international. It spans international boundaries. And I've always been independent, and for some reason, they respect my independence. So you add that layer to this whole Velikovsky affair, and those people understanding that Velikovsky is very right. Very interesting situation. And then, on top of that, eventually the CIA becomes involved in all of this because of the discovery of Planet X by Robert Harrington, which happened in 1991. Now, I'm jumping ahead. I'm kind of leapfrogging ahead a little bit here just to give you a perspective. And Dan Golden comes in, takes over NASA from the CIA because they have now discovered the Planet X object that had been searched for since Uranus and Neptune were discovered in the 1700s and 1800s. You know, in Tombaugh's discovery of Pluto, they knew that was not the Planet X object. The Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft going out, they actually were using those to try and determine if there was an object pulling on them and changing their orbits, and that would have been a very good estimate of gravitational perturbations due to a Planet X-type object. But they were far enough away because the actual Planet X object was way down in the solar system and really did not affect those space probes because they were in the ecliptic. They were very close to the ecliptic, etc. So anyway, then, not to make things any more complicated, but around the year 2004, the CIA picks up on one of the Velikovsky con men, what I mentioned Velikovsky had attached to him, some con men, picks up on these con men and starts to fabricate a bunch of Looney Tune science and try to take my material and turn it into nutcase science to try and defame me, to take the terms that I had developed like electric universe and change it into nutcase science and then support this in a big way so that when people, because at that point I was, in terms of the population, the general population, I was becoming very well known. On major radio stations, on talk show hosts, my books were out, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes. And the one thing that they made sure, because this group had handlers, the one thing they made sure is that they never, ever, ever talked about Planet X, which was big on the CIA's mind because of the Harrington discovery. And so at any rate, you can understand this is a general outline, but the complicated aspect of this, and then when you get to a public setting, then in all of the universities, in if anything related to electrical nature of the universe came up or whatever, it was very easy for all of the trolls and the outreach agents being paid under the table by NASA to simply say, oh, this has long since been proven wrong. Velikovsky is wrong. There's no need to talk about it anymore. And, this is the scenario around that grew out of the Velikovsky issues. And this whole cast of characters. And what the one thing that happened also is that it made it very easy for standard science, Tier 2 science, to simply categorize anything that they didn't like as fringe science or pseudoscience and put that label, it's one of those Velikovsky lunatic fringe nutcase pseudoscientists. And they could leave it at that, and nobody in Tier 2 science would touch it with a 10-foot pole because their job, their career, their publications, their grant money would all be at risk. Not only at risk, it would just go away overnight if they crossed that line. So you can see that it requires a bit of time to put this into perspective. And like I said, it was around that 1981, it was the spring of 1981 when I left Cornell, the end of the spring semester. And it was shortly after that that I discovered the whole Velikovsky issue. And it was shortly thereafter that they invited me to write my what turned out to be the three-part Comet paper. And so it gave me a platform. It was good and bad. It's one of those two-edged swords in which it was very good because it gave me a platform to write exactly what I wanted to write. It was edited, like I said. Leroy Ellenberger was a kind of a jerk. I'm saying anybody that knew him, but he was a tough editor, and that's what I needed to really improve what I was doing, and that's what an editor does. They take what you're doing, and they give you good constructive criticism, and that's what he did, and I got to give him credit for that. And so the three-part Comet paper is a very good compendium of the state of things at that point in time. So it was not just something that I, say, copyrighted myself. It was published in a peer-reviewed journal, not the one I would have wanted. All of that, mind you, all of that and a lot more should have been published in peer-reviewed astrophysics, space science, and astronomy journals. But it wasn't. It wasn't to be, it wasn't in the cards because I had been blackballed from ever submitting any of those, and the people who were publishing my articles were blackballed also. They were on the firing line. And it's like, say, journalists from a major newspaper or whatever. They have to print and kowtow to NASA. And why is that? Because if they say something negative about NASA, then NASA will not give them any more interviews, and they will be out of the space reporting business, because NASA's going to go, hey, don't talk to those guys. They write bad stuff about us. So in that sense, NASA controls the narrative about NASA. I mean, they can do criminal activity, and they'll come out smelling like a rose in the press, because the press cannot, they're press-proof. You might say that, because they're just like they're Congress-proof. No congressman or representative in the federal government will ever deny NASA one of its bids for money, because NASA has this program where they're so big, they spread out their business through every congressional district. Very wise thing to do. And so if any congressman or any representative says anything negative about NASA or votes against one of their programs, then NASA will cut out the employment into that representative's sector, into their region. And then it will be publicized, this senator ruining the employment in this region, and that would be like political suicide. So anyway, no representative, and this even got up, you could see Trump buckling under this when he was president, and he didn't buckle to the EPA or the other agencies, but to NASA he did. And that's why, because of this NASA Congress-proof, press-proof thing that's been going on for decades and decades. Okay, so at any rate, I hope that rounds out this whole discussion and fills in a bit of history. Now, there have been many other people that have come into this arena and have many conclusions. They might be archaeologists. They might be anthropologists. They might be geologists. They might be people from other fields that, say, are studying geology. There's a recent wave just right now. We're just right now in the year 2022. But there's been a huge recent wave of people dealing with geological factors showing that there was a pole shift. And we know where the old pole was. It was up in the Northwest Territories of Canada in Hudson Bay. And so we know almost exactly where the old North Pole was. And I studied that because back in the 90s, I was going to the Mayan cities with surveying equipment, surveying these cities and understanding that they were off kilter by like Chichen Itza, 13 and a half degrees. And so we know today that absolutely there was a pole shift. The city of Chichen Itza was built on the old gridwork. and that the old grid work from before the Venus pole shift. And oddly enough, Chichen Itza, the main temple platform, is dedicated to Venus, not the sun, not the moon, as with the Aztecs, who came later. But even the Aztecs carry over this whole issue of Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, from the Maya. It was just like the Romans took certain mythological characteristics from the Greeks and molded them into what we know as Roman mythology. But really, it was from the Greeks, and the Greeks got it from their ancestors who basically lived through the Venus event. So that's where things are today. And also I wanted to clarify where things were in the year 1981, historically, where was the Tier 2 science? Tier 2 and Tier 1 science had already been well established. And I know for also that the Tier 1 scientists really didn't understand about comets either. When I came along and I did my work and I laid all this out, I know because these people talk to me. They come out and say, they're learning a lot from what I did, the understanding of the differential current of protons in the solar wind, something that nobody understood, or how that interacted, or how that created the dust cloud that's held back by solar wind pressure out beyond the orbit of Pluto. Nobody knew about any of this. In fact, they did not know about the Kuiper Belt objects at that point. And that's something that was another thing that I predicted in my work, is that there would be a lot of planets forming out in this dust cloud in the form of comets discharging that local capacitor, but with an abundance of material to draw in so that you would have thousands and thousands of planets literally forming. And I showed pictures in my Planet X, in my three-part comet paper, one of them being the Eskimo Nebula, or was it the Owl's Eye Nebula, one of the famous nebulas, showing the comets forming out in the outer nebula. And you can see them. You can just see them forming. You can see the comets, and you can see the planets forming. And it's a very dynamic process. These are going on, and of course, now they're discovering thousands of planets out in that region. It's where the nebular ion cloud is. In fact, Pluto is continually forming. The planet Pluto is snowing. It's snowing in the atmosphere, and there's no clouds. It's just coming in from outer space and snowing. It's primarily, there's some water mixed in, but it's primarily nitrogen-hydrogen compounds like ammonia that are just raining in from outer space. And you can see the comet formation around Pluto when the New Horizons spacecraft was approaching. I was watching, and you can see the comet comas around Pluto and its companion moon Charon. So anyway, that's another one of the major discoveries that I predicted was the formation of planets in this region. And of course, standard science has no idea why there are thousands of planets out there. And they're not just in nice orbits in the ecliptic plane, they're all over the place. So at any rate, I want to project into the future a little bit here. The disinformation campaigns that raged throughout the 90s and the 2000s, etc., were planned. And the CIA began this when they took over NASA in 1991 because of the discovery of Planet X by Robert Harrington. And I'll be talking in detail about these, but they began at that point to plan a massive disinformation campaign, which resulted in the crazy lady talks to aliens, Planet X coming, we're all going to die, May 15, 2003, if you remember that, if you lived through that crazy times. Once again, my work was central to the repelling of all of that. And, of course, they tried to mix me in with these people. People would say, well, when do you predict Planet X would come? And I'd say, I don't make predictions unless I have sound scientific information. It was just raging. It took down Art Bell. It took down, at the height of his fame, Art Bell was taken down and his show basically taken away from him that he had built up. But then remember 2000, the millennium bug that was supposedly all the computer systems were going to go down, we were all going to die. And then the 2012, the Mayan calendar, end of the so-called Mayan calendar, and we're all going to die. You know, the world was going to come to an end. And then during those years, the mid-2000s, that every week there was a new book coming out, Planet X was imminent, we were all going to die, and people with their baseball hat on backwards, and all published by the CIA. These were all published by the same publishing house with the same glossy cover, and they had one thing in common, is that on the cover there was a big orange ball, and the big orange ball would imply that that's what Planet X was supposed to look like, but of course, that is not the case, because Planet X would look like a comet, and it did. It was Hale-Bopp. It was up in the sky, and that was just one of many. And then also, interestingly enough, the Vatican is involved with building telescopes and working behind the scenes, the CIA being the police force of the World Bank, which is the front agency for the Vatican Bank. The Rothschild Bank is the front agency, the International Monetary Fund, World Bank. And the CIA, housed in the United States, is the police force, the worldwide police force, to ensure the hegemony dominance of the U.S. dollar, etc., and the British pound, which are the central to the entire global monetary system, etc. So the Vatican is deeply involved in this through the Jesuits that run it. The Jesuits are taking over all of the universities and a lot of the communications, the news media in the United States. So that just gives you this. Now let's go back to 1981, when I'm talking about 1981 right now. Here we are, looking out into the future, and my work is now well known. It's very well established in terms of scientific data, and all of this is yet to come. So there's never a dull moment, let's put it this way, and my work is central to this all the way through from day one. There's been a, you know, it's been a constant struggle to keep this from being dragged into insanity, because there have been huge efforts to take my work and turn it into craziness. And once again, I work alone. Everybody knows me. They know my work. They understand who I am and what I'm doing. And after all of these decades, I'm still here and moving along and making great new discoveries all the time. But anyway, I had to do this show to encapsulate the absolute insanity that was involved in the Velikovsky issue and everything else that came after. So once again, we'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.